Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, June 20th. Shouts of joy emanating from the formerly known Mistake by the Lake, Cleveland, Ohio. 52 years of title-starved desolation. Now reaching an oasis of sorts led by LeBron. King James bringing a title back to Cleveland. We'll talk at the bottom of the hour with probably the biggest Cleveland fan and priest that I know. He is Father Damian Ferentz. He was on with us last week after the improbable win by the Cavaliers in Oakland to extend the series after falling down 3-1 and now becoming the first team in NBA history to come back from a 3-1 deficit. And not only that, to do it against a team that set the all-time record for regular season wins, everyone's, it seems like, eternally beloved Golden State Warriors. So what a performance by King James. What a performance by Kyrie Irving, who served notice and played great, and the Cavs played great defense as well on the Splash Brothers. So we'll talk to Father Damian at the bottom of the hour, as I'm sure he will. He's going to make some sort of spiritual analogies and connections between the Cavaliers' victory and what he does as a priest. He'll also tell us a little bit about a Catholic nerd camp that he has started there at Borromeo Seminary in the Diocese of Cleveland, where he teaches. We're also going to talk a little bit today about secular Sabbaths, interesting trend that I'm noticing, and what it could mean. Also, internet manners and Fulton Sheen, story that you're going to like about an elderly British woman. And we'll also spin the Dollar Catechism wheel and take your phone calls as well. 573-4BREAD-4. If you've got a comment or a question, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. As I said, our question of the day is taken from today's gospel reading, which is taken from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 7, part of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said to his disciples, "Stop judging that you may not be judged," or as it says in the old King James, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." One of the most oft-quoted passages from the Sermon on the Mount, and is usually done to sort of shut down any sort of moral criticism that anyone may have of a behavior or a group of persons. What did Jesus mean by that? What did he mean by judge not? And how good do you think you are at obeying him? Scale of 1 to 10. 1 being you are judgy McJudge pants. Number 10, you don't ever question or think about the motives or evaluate the behavior of anyone on any level. Like I said, I'd be shocked if anybody is a 10. It probably means you are blissfully unaware of your own weaknesses. It'd be kind of like if you rated yourself a 10 in humility. You know, I'll stack my humility up against anybody. You might be missing the point. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime in, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a response on Facebook or on Twitter. Let's see, Mao posting on Facebook says, "When you are away from the church, it's normal to have a tendency to judge, and this is because by not being close to God, we feel like gods and is self-sufficient with our wisdom, not one bit about the wisdom of God." Interesting. Because, you know, oftentimes in the New Testament anyway, it is the most religious. It's the religious leaders. It's Simon the Pharisee or others, for example, who tend to be the most quick to judge the spiritual state of another person. But I hear what you're saying there, because, you know, oftentimes it's those who are most critical of the church as being judgmental, or Catholics as being judgmental, who are judgmental in their own way and are not hesitant at all to weigh in on the character of someone else. It just depends on whatever your particular pet issue is that you take issue with. We all do it to some degree. I hope you had a great Father's Day yesterday. Like I said, if your earthly father is still around, then give thanks for that and appreciate him, even if he's been imperfect, which we all are. I miss my dad terribly. 29 years now, almost, since his passing. And every Father's Day without him is one too many. And yet he has left a major imprint on me. As I said last hour, I made a comment yesterday that got a little bit of blowback on Twitter. I said, not all fathers are good, but fatherhood is. Somebody thought, a couple people, I think, thought I was sort of bashing fathers. And that was not the case at all. I didn't mean it that way. And, of course, I guess the fault is mine if it was perceived that way. What I meant is that we're all imperfect. Look, I mean, when I go to confession, which is not often enough, but when I go to confession, two-thirds of the things that I confess have to do with my own shortcomings as a father, as a husband, shortness of temper, not praying enough for my children, losing, you know, a lack of patience, selfishness, whatever it may be. And then I see it. I see it in my children at times. The old saying goes, you know, your children are most likely to walk in the footsteps you thought you'd covered up. So, you know, I think anybody with even the minimum self-awareness knows their imperfections as a father. But even our imperfections, even the fact that we fail, and even though there are some fathers who abandon their children, for example, or abuse their children, not all fathers are good. I think that's axiomatic. But fatherhood is, because we participate in some way in the God who is a father by his very nature. And so fatherhood, something worth celebrating. Now, I can, you know, honestly, Father's Day, as the hallmark chosen third Sunday in June, okay, as some people have pointed out from the Catholic perspective, would love to have Father's Day on the feast day of St. Joseph, March 19th. St. Joseph, who becomes for us the model and really the patron of earthly fathers, foster father of Jesus, defender of the family, defender of the church, would be in a more appropriate day. But, you know, we live in a culture where dual citizens and all the rest, so we'll keep Hallmark ticking and we'll celebrate Father's Day. But it's worth doing because fatherhood is a good thing. We celebrated at my house Saturday evening because yesterday morning sent my wife and four of our children off to Nashville, Tennessee, to the Catholic Heart Work Camp, which is a week-long work mission camp. I'd ask for your prayers for them and for all those who are participating that are camped out at St. John Paul II High School there in Nashville and doing some home repair and also having some real an opportunity for a spiritual retreat. So anyway, so we ended up yesterday. I've still got my 10-year-old and my 16-year-old son at home, so it was a little bit more of a quiet. Though we did go see Finding Dory yesterday, at least my 10-year-old daughter and me. 16-year-old son wasn't much interested, imagine that. But we went to go see Finding Dory, and I think I only slept for about 10 minutes in the middle of it, which is pretty good for me if you know me. That tells you it was a good movie. I don't think I'm ready to say it was as good as Finding Nemo, but it was a very worthy sequel and had some very touching moments and also very much a celebration of family life. So, yeah, and I mean, Ellen's voice, perfect for Dory, Ellen DeGeneres, no doubt. It was really, really good. So I had a good time with my 10-year-old daughter yesterday, but I didn't shed a tear. My daughters asked me because they know I can get a little emotional in movies. I don't cry in cartoons. Don't know why. It takes live action to get this these moist eyes ratcheted up. Anyway, maybe if you've seen it, you want to share it. Stephen Gray Donis, I noticed, with a really good review of Finding Dory. Anyway, back to what the Holy Father was talking about that he's taken some criticism for. And that was a remark that he made while in Rome there during at the Pastoral Congress, where he was talking about living in a culture of the provisional in which many couples getting married say yes for the rest of my life without knowing what they're committing to. And for that reason, quote, the great majority of sacramental marriages are null. Well, evidently, when the official transcript came out, the majority had been changed to either the some sacramental marriages are null. And there's been a lot of kerfuffle about that. Who changed the Pope's remarks? Was it irresponsible of Pope Francis to impugn the validity of so many marriages which were pursued with good intentions throughout the world? Is he in some way ignoring the natural capacity to marriage? And this is, again, a Catholic idea that marriage is not something that is simply a Catholic reality. It's not some Catholic thing imposed from without. Marriage is a human reality, written into human nature from the very beginning. It transcends cultures. It predates the church, predates Judaism. It is not only a divine reality, it's a human reality written into our very nature. And therefore, there is, and people who understand natural law talk about this, there is the natural capacity to marry. One doesn't have to know Catholic theology or even be a Christian, even a believer in God, to have a basic innate understanding of what marriage is and to commit oneself to it. So we'll pick this back up on the other side of the break, because I think it's an important point, something that makes me sympathetic to what the Pope has in mind and maybe the reasons he said it. But we'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Love to hear from you this morning. Maybe some of the most quoted words by Jesus ever. Judge not, lest ye be judged. What do you think Jesus meant by that? And how good are you at obeying it on a scale of 1 to 10? Judge yourself on how well you judge others. I think we do have an instinctive tendency. It's part of our fallenness, I think, to hold others to a higher standard than we hold ourselves. But what does it mean to not judge? Because I don't think any of us believe it's an absolute sense. If it's an absolute sense, then no Christian could ever serve as a judge, for example, in a courtroom. We could never make any we could never discriminate, for example, in hiring a person. For example, if someone had a track record of theft, getting fired from jobs for embezzlement, we couldn't take that into account when we hire them. Nobody believes that in an absolute sense. But what does it mean then? What does it mean to not judge another person? Is it simply that we don't judge the state of their soul? We try to be empathetic, perhaps, toward the realities that make certain choices possible. Is it a deep mindfulness of our own need for mercy, of the fact that we are ourselves saved by grace and a work in progress? What do you think our Lord meant? Seems apparent from the context. He certainly that latter thing about keeping the scrutiny on ourselves rather than on others is an important thing. But we all, I think, have to deal with this question. Depends on what values that we hold most dear, that we are most offended when they appear to be violated. What is it about ourselves that tends to believe the worst or to believe the negative about someone else? What did Jesus mean by those words? 573-4-BREAD-4, you can call me or text to that number. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. As I said, they're often quoted words, but I think sometimes they are misrepresented and misused as well. So I'd love to hear from you on that. Bottom of the hour here in about, 13 minutes, we're going to talk to Father Damien Ference, father who teaches at Borromeo Seminary in the Diocese of Cleveland, and he is a huge and long-suffering Cleveland sports fan. And I know for a fact he was all wrought up last night watching the Warriors and the Cavaliers. And I know he has not seen LeBron James return to Cleveland, and now he's leading them to the championship as simply a sports reality, but having deeper implications. And we'll let him tell us all about that at the bottom of the hour, as well as his Catholic Nerd Camp that's coming up, actually going on, I think, this week. So if we can catch him, if he's not still out there with the masses in celebratory mode in Cleveland, we'll get him on here. 573-4BREAD-4, as I said, if you want to chime in with your thoughts or questions, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Anyway, back to Pope Francis and what he had to say about many modern marriages. Maybe, I think he said, most modern marriages, and it's created quite a stir that they think Pope Francis is simply giving a free pass to couples to walk away from their marriage because they could rightly say, oh, well, you know, the Pope says our marriage probably isn't even valid anyway, which, of course, is only for the judgment of a competent tribunal who looks at all the circumstances when the couple shares in their vows and whether or not there was something that compromised their consent. Because it's the consent that makes the marriage. A declaration of nullity doesn't make a marriage null. It recognizes that there was something lacking in that marriage from the beginning. And by the way, it's all about from the beginning. For example, if a couple's married 20 years and then one spouse abandons the other spouse, or one spouse cheats on the other spouse, that doesn't make a marriage null. It means that someone failed to live up to the vows that they made. Adultery does not create nullity. Now, it could be, if a pattern could be shown, that from the earliest days of the marriage, infidelity was a regular thing, then that could be evidence toward the idea that one of the spouses did not fully intend to be faithful from the beginning. And that's really all it takes. It only takes one of the spouses to have something lacking in their consent in order for a marriage to be invalid. But here's the point I think the Pope was trying to make. He was trying to make the point that we need to be more diligent in educating young people, or all those who are entering into marriage, to help them overcome their, quote, resistance, delusions, and fears. In a sense, I think he was saying, look, we have to recognize the fact that we live in a world where we're all drinking from the same tainted well in terms of our understanding of marriage. And therefore, it's all the more important that we take the time, not only for the engaged couple, but in the other aspects of marriage preparation, those which are sometimes called the remote and the proximate. In other words, from infancy, where we're being shaped about marriage, whether we're aware of it or not, explicitly or not, that first curriculum of our home, and then to the proximate when we come into adolescence. We have to do more. Have to do more. To understand how we can shape and form people to understand the permanence and the totality of their marital commitment. So I lost in all the kerfuffle about the Pope's words. As I said, you know, if you do it in charity, if you know the full evidence, and you know what you're talking about, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong about saying, I think the Pope used poor judgment here. St. Paul did that with St. Peter, whatever. I don't know that that's the case. I haven't read the story enough. I know there's a lot that often gets lost in the translation. Not sure that's the case here. Who knows? But let's don't miss the larger point, which is that, yes, there are a lot of people who enter into marriage without an adequate understanding of what they're entering into. And here's the thing. And this is something I discovered to my surprise teaching my religion class at the local Catholic high school here. We got into to marriage. It wasn't, I think, this semester, but last semester. Got into what makes marriage marriage in the Catholic understanding. And the biggest thing they tripped and stumbled over was this very idea of indissolubility, that a marriage validly entered into cannot be dissolved by anything except death. It's that permanence of the commitment threw my 16 and 17-year-old students for a loop. It really took me aback. They were like, so you're saying that if they don't love each other anymore, they just got to stay in it? Or, well, what if people change their mind? That's unrealistic, isn't it? and so forth and so on. And finally, I don't know why, it was, I guess, one of those days I'd reached a point. I said, look, you guys are supposed to be the idealists. You're young. You're the ones who's supposed to believe that love can last and that love will last. Like, it really was, to me, eye-opening to how the lack of permanence has filtered its way down and even jaded those who would normally, you would think, be the dreamers. So I think there's something to what Pope Francis has said. Maybe he, in retrospect, decided he should say some rather than most. Whatever. I think there's a lot of smoke here, not a lot of fire, in my opinion. Anyway, another thing I've noted lately, and it came across this in the New York Times over the weekend, a piece about how Bill Nye spends his Sundays. Bill Nye, the science guy. You know, Bill Nye, of course, known as being very secular, not religious at all. Science is his religion, I guess you could say, and so forth. And it was an interesting article about the ease with which he spends his Sundays. There were some photos of him. I think I maybe even shared one on the show's blog page of him sitting in his recliner, taking it easy, enjoying his Sunday. I saw another recent article a few weeks ago on the website cupofjoe.com, written, edited by Joanne Goddard, I think her name is, who is very much a modern secularist feminist. And she had an article about how one particular virus, not religious, ends her Sundays. And so, again, the idea being that you don't have to be a person of faith to enjoy a Sunday rest. In fact, and there was almost an undercurrent of almost better to be unreligious, because you don't have to lose that hour of doing that inconvenient thing of like going to church. You know what I'm saying? It's like that old joke, what's the difference between a drunk and an alcoholic? Well, if you're just a drunk, you don't have to go to all those meetings. You know, well, why not enjoy your Sunday without having to go to church? I even came across this article from The Atlantic from a few years ago by a former Orthodox Jew in terms of practice. The case for the Sabbath, even if you're not religious. Here's the thing that always strikes me, though, about these sorts of articles, is there's never any sense of self-awareness. There's not even any deference to, you know, giving thanks, perhaps, for the religious worldview, the Judeo-Christian tradition that actually wrote into Western culture this idea of Sabbath rhythm and Sabbath rest. It's you want to enjoy the fruit of something without recognizing the foundation that even made it possible. And this is where secularism, I think, in many ways, can be sort of parasitic at times without even knowing it. And understanding that the freedoms that are enjoyed very much because of a foundation of faith. We'll get back to this at the bottom of the hour. At the end of the hour. We'll be back with Father Damian Ference. This is the Mike Allen Show. Right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show on this Monday, June 20th. Pleased to have on the phone, fresh off a celebratory night, Father Damian Ference. Father Damian, a priest from the Diocese of Cleveland, also teaches philosophy and theology at the Borromeo Seminary there, and probably the most passionate Cavs fan wearing a collar. Good morning, Father Damian.
Good morning, Mike. From the city of champions, Cleveland, Ohio. The Diocese of Cleveland, I should say, too.
No longer the mistake by the lake.
You've got it. It's all been washed away. It happened last night with LeBron James. He he did what he said he would, and he brought us a championship, and it's unbelievable. It's a very strange feeling to be a Clevelander and to come out on the winning side of things in sports anyway. So yeah, it's a big day. Day here in Cleveland.
You've come a long way since the drive and the fumble. I'm not sure if you're old enough to remember those plays back in the day, you know, with the Browns and the Broncos. But as I told you off the air, I anybody's listening to this program knows I really got into the Warriors this year. I enjoyed Steph Curry. I enjoyed the way they played the game. It was exciting. You know, here they were setting a record, regular season wins. And I had been one of those who had been a little bit critical of LeBron. You know, two titles, yes, but also three falling short. But I found myself, as the series went along, I couldn't help but admire the pluck of the Cavaliers. That I could sense the hunger of the Cleveland sports fandom, and to be quite frank, the way that they comported themselves on and off the court, as compared to maybe a couple of Warriors who will remain nameless, but everyone knows who they are. I found myself more sympathetic to the Cavaliers last night, and then the overwhelming flood of emotions from the players and coaching staff. It was pretty neat to see.
It was beautiful to see. I'm here at Borromeo, and I started this camp a few years back. So I had 14 teenagers from around the diocese, plus a few of my seminarians, plus a couple of brother priests. And we were watching, and we were hoping, and we were holding our breath. And man, when that final buzzer hit, we kind of didn't know. We jumped around and hugged each other, but then we didn't know what to do because the last championship we had in Cleveland was 64. I was born in 76. I don't remember it. I don't remember watching Jim Brown, but I do remember, as you say, the fumble. I remember getting beat by John Elway. I remember losing the World Series in 95 and 97. I remember LeBron leaving town. So ESPN had this 30 for 30 series called Cleveland, and it was all about how our Cleveland sports were. We ended everything in losses. And so to rewrite the ship and to rewrite the story it's something. I only got 4 hours of sleep last night, so I'm still trying to figure it all out. But I am going, and I'm taking my teams to that parade on Wednesday. We've never had a parade in downtown Cleveland for a championship, so it's going to be something.
You tweeted last night, certainly a famous quote from the Magnificat, "He has cast down the mighty from their thrones and has lifted up the lowly."
That's it. We're the underdogs. Cleveland's the underdogs. Everybody thought that Golden State was going to do this. What, 73 wins? They beat the Chicago Bulls record with 72, and they were up on us 3-1, and no team in NBA history has ever come back to win, especially on the road, especially against what was thought to be the best team in NBA history. And we did it. And LeBron did it. And Kyrie did it. And the whole team did it. It was awesome.
Yeah,
so awesome.
Kyrie Irving, I mean, that third quarter last night was... I mean, of course, you know, I mean, everybody knows he's a great player, but boy, he just seized that game by the throat and then hit, of course, the biggest shot of his career, that big three.
He did. Well, the nice thing, too, I think he's 23 years old or 24. Maybe I think he's 24 years old. He's a young guy. And, of course, this was the deepest he ever got in the playoffs. Last year was the first time he got in the playoffs, and then he busted his knee in game one of the finals, so it was LeBron trying to do everything. But, man, he's got his sidekick now, those two. And actually, Kevin Love had a good game. He didn't match up well against Golden State, but last night he pulled down 14 rebounds, I think, maybe half of them were offensive. So Kevin Love, he did something special last night, too.
Now, you had a little bit of a funny Twitter back and forth with a sister Miriam James, who is a big Warriors fan, evidently.
You know, it's funny that at first she didn't come across like she was a big Warriors fan. It was one of her sisters in the community, Sister Mary. So when she'd say, "Oh, Sister Mary this, Sister Mary that," and then I'd ask, and then we'd go back and forth a little bit, so... Yeah, it was some friendly Catholic banter, and they got theirs last year. So we Cleveland, we got ours last night. It was pretty great. So I didn't go after the sister, other than, you know, applying a line from the Magnificat to our situation. I thought that was fun and fair.
One of the things that you tweeted last night was that this was that if you know the city of Cleveland, this is about more than just basketball.
That's true. I mean, a lot of people went, and this isn't true in the last year too, but a good part of my life. You say you're from Cleveland. Oh, it's a mistake by the lake. Isn't yours the city where the river caught on fire? And it actually did because of all the pollution. And back in 67, I think that happened. And all the sports that have gone down. And we've also had people come to our city, try to make a living here, and then leave because economically we've been hurting for a while. We're part of the Rust Belt. You know, we were manufacturing, steel industry, auto industry, and when all those jobs went away, it became a depressed place economically and even emotionally at times. You know, and the winters are very hard here. This is a hard-working town. It's a blue-collar town. This isn't for wimps, that's for sure. But that changed last night, and, you know, people, they're probably still out in the streets. The celebration was, as the kids would say, off the hook. I mean, whew, it was something. So this is good. And the RNC is happening here this summer. They picked Cleveland, and the Indians are playing well. Actually, our minor league hockey team just won a championship, so it's turning around. And it would be nice if people did what LeBron did. You go away for a while, but come back, bring your gifts back to Northeast Ohio. Let's rebuild this part of the country. Let's rebuild this part of the state. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with an ecstatic Father Damian Ference, a priest from the Diocese of Cleveland and professor at the Borromeo Seminary there. Tell us a little bit about, you said you've got some young people that have come in. This is a camp, you called it kind of a Catholic nerd camp. It's named in the Latin, Tole Lege. Tell us a little bit about the name and the idea behind the camp and what you're hoping to accomplish.
Sure. Well, St. Augustine, in Book 8 of the Confessions, just before he had his conversion, he's got this famous moment where he's bawling his eyes out, trying to figure out how he can shake this terrible habit of lust and some of the sins that he's struggling with. And he hears what sounds like children saying, tole lege, which in Latin means take up and read. And Anthony of the Desert, at one point in his life, picked up scriptures, basically played Bible roulette, and it changed his life. So he said, maybe I'm supposed to take up the epistle. So he takes up Paul's epistle, one of his epistles, and starts reading. And sure enough, it like the word melts his heart and his life changes. So that's what our camp's named after, take up and read. Because what we do here is every day for 1 week straight, we have a philosophy course, we have a theology course, we teach the kids the liturgy of the hours. These are young people going into their senior year of high school preparing for college. But we also get them involved in the Diocese of Cleveland doing cultural events. So we'll go to an Indians game. We went to watch parties for the Cavs last year. We go to the art museum. We visit historic churches. And we go out to dinner or lunch a couple times at some pretty cool ethnic restaurants in Cleveland. So part of my idea for running this camp is to do what other camps do spiritually or pastorally for the intellectual part of a young person, in order that hopefully we can keep them after they go off to college, bring their gifts back to the diocese so they can serve here and build up the community here. So that's the camp in a nutshell. It's like, you know, some schools have AP English, AP History, AP this, AP that. We would be the AP Catholicism, Advanced Placement Catholicism.
Well, and to be honest with you, I mean, I think there are a lot of Catholic schools, Catholic high schools, who do not treat the Catholic faith as intellectually, academically, to the same with the same level of seriousness that they treat some other subjects, and so for them to have an opportunity to see that their faith has a deep intellectual tradition can only help prepare them for some of the assaults they're going to experience on their intellect in college.
You've got it. I think all too often, you know, even some parents will say, oh, come on, you gave my kid a B in religion. This is just, God loves us. Of course God loves us. But if our faith is the most important thing and your chemistry professor or teachers are giving you hours of homework a night and your English teachers and your history, wouldn't you expect in theology that we'd be taking this discipline seriously too. So that's what we do here. And I have two of my colleagues, one both have their doctorates, one in philosophy, one in theology. They do that teaching. I do, for this, I feel like a parish priest again. I do a couple formal moments of teaching, but for the most part, I do the relational stuff. But even when we're out in the city, they're learning and coming in to understand what it means to be a faithful young adult Catholic and how that looks. Mm. Mm.
Father, thank you so much for your time. I think time always goes too fast, but thank you so much for your time. And go Cavs! Live it up.
Thank you, Mike. Go Cavs.
All right.
We'll City of Champions.
Take care, Father. We'll be back in a minute with more. We'll spin the Dollar Catechism wheel. This is the Mike Allen Show on Breadbox Media.